If you're thinking about reducing your screen time, you might be wondering if opting out of being on the internet altogether is even possible anymore. The internet knows a lot about all of us, but how much exactly? Where is it coming from? And can it be stopped? You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ray Johnston, and welcome to episode one of our special series, Opt Out, the Download This Show guide to taking back control of your online life. I'm going to take you on my own personal journey, from finding out how much of my highly personal info is out there, to figuring out how to scrub it and lock it all down. And episode one is all about auditing your digital footprint. It's becoming more and more common to see data breaches in our news headlines. And you cannot be blamed for getting a little bit bored of people telling you to lock down your accounts and be privacy conscious. But just how much of your info is actually out there? And if you've got nothing to hide, is there really anything to worry about? Spoiler, yes. To learn a little more about what happens to all of our data in all the nooks and crannies of the internet, I spoke to Yael Grauer, an investigative tech reporter out of the US covering privacy and security, digital freedom, hacking, and mass surveillance. So what kind of information are you finding?
There'll be like people's names and addresses, links to all of their social media accounts, including ones that they set up with different names. I can find information about former addresses, housemates, family members, all sorts of information.
Wow.
Yeah, so sometimes people will compare it to what's in the phone book, and I'm like, this is way worse than what's in a phone book or used to be in the phone books of yore, because those you could opt out of with one single form or call, and also it didn't have as much information. It just had your name, address, and phone number. And now we're finding just so many, you can just spend hours digging through what you find on these sites.
So what got you first interested in digital privacy as a journalist?
I was getting some sketchy emails, actually. And at the time I was a health writer and I wrote about like social media marketing, stuff like that. And I was getting a lot of threatening emails and people who knew a lot more information about me. I had no idea where they got the information. And so I started kind of digging into it for my own personal safety. At the time, there was a site, I think it's archived now, there was a site called Geek Feminism that had a list of information about what you could do to try to protect yourself online. And I spent a really long time going through it and realized that a lot of what I'd done wasn't really hitting at what I was trying to protect. And I had spent so much time on it, I was a freelancer at the time, that I was like, I have to start writing about this if I want to make money this month.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm about to embark, or I am embarking on a similar journey myself, having reported on technology for almost 15 years and working across multiple sites and trying every platform that exists out there in the line of my work. I'm doing an audit of my online presence. For anyone who is new to this, what should they expect when they first try to audit their digital footprint?
You'll probably have a lot more information out there about you that you didn't realize. So it can be a little scary, actually. Like I found an old live journal that I kept in college under a pseudonym that had a lot of information that I'm glad I found and was able to take down before anybody that I know of got to it. But people have so much information. I've found, just kind of casually browsing, I've seen people's wedding videos. Like, I've helped people remove their information and I'm like, wow, your divorce records are up, your wedding videos, every single handle that you used to use. So I don't know, it's kind of frustrating because I feel like there's a lot of information that I want to find that is just gone. And yet there's echoes of things that I don't even remember and definitely don't want out there that I found.
As someone who has written for sites that have, you know, now become defunct and all of my work that I did for them has been stripped from the internet, I can totally relate to that feeling. So most people have no idea what data brokers do. Can you break down their role? How do they work?
Yeah, so data broker, well, there's different types of data brokers. The one that I spend the most time looking into is people search sites, and they collect information about people and they will either sell it or give it away to other people. So it's a third-party service. You don't interact with this service, but other people who might be trying to find you do interact with it. And a lot of the information that they get is from public records or social media. And then there's other types of data brokers as well. Like there are companies that will create sort of dossiers of individuals and their shopping habits. They'll put them in categories and sell those for marketing purposes. And then there's also a third kind, which is probably the least invasive, and they make sure that they do verification, like identity verification, to make sure that if you are taking out a loan, like you are who you say you are.
So there's people that deal with the data that they receive from breaches. And then there are others that legally collect data and sell it as well, right?
So I usually use the site Have I Been Pwned, and that will tell you where your information has been leaked. It's usually your email address, probably a password, your name, sometimes your address and other information. Those are really hard to remove. You can't really opt out of those because somebody will just post it somewhere. Most of what I worked on is helping people get out of people search sites that are collecting things legally and also allow you to opt out, but they don't all allow everybody to opt out. So it gets really complicated. It gets a little tricky because they don't have to in all locations. It depends on what the law, like the state or federal or international law that they're following, that they have to follow. But some of them will allow you to opt out as a courtesy. But yeah, if your information has been stolen and it's in a paste bin somewhere, then it's really hard to get that taken down, though you might be able to get it de-indexed in a search engine.
Right, right. So could you just walk us through what a basic digital footprint audit should include?
I guess I would start with the information you're most worried about people finding, which for a lot of people is your home address. So you can Google your name and your home address or any combination of information. Some people will just Google an address to see if their name is associated with it. So that's one place that you can start. But you can also look for your information specifically on people search sites like Axiom, Ancestry.com is one, Cluster Maps, Dataveria, Intellius, My Life. And then some of them will allow you to request removal of your data. But yeah, we mentioned Have I Been Pwned. That's also another place where if somebody's gotten into your account, then they might have the information that has been posted in that account or shared in that account. So that's another place that you can start by changing passwords for accounts that have been breached. But yeah, it really depends on the person and what they are worried about. Personally, I don't care as much about my phone number. My phone number has been public at various times, so I'm not as concerned. But some people really don't want their number out there. So it depends on what information you're trying to make sure is removed.
Finding out how much of your personal information is online, I can imagine that it's a pretty overwhelming experience. So do you have any advice for dealing with the anxiety that might come on during this process and not just getting stuck and abandoning the whole thing?
Yeah, that's a really tough one. I think for me, the most important thing is to prioritize it and realize for most people, you're probably not in a situation where you have to get everything done at once and stay up for 5 days until it's all removed. So what I try to do with a data broker opt-out list is I use little emoji to tell people start with these. If you only have time to do, you know, 5 sites, 10 sites, start with these. There's also other things that you can do. A lot of times people are worried about social media information being leaked, but they're actually posting publicly. So you can change the privacy settings on your accounts that are public. Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes you need to take a step back and think, like, what is it that I'm most worried about and what can I actually do? I think where people get paranoid is that they will decide things could be happening that might not actually be happening. Like they're like, oh, what if somebody has access to all of my devices? But a lot of times when there's information out there that people are worried about, it's because of word of mouth or like, you know, somebody still has access to, maybe they used to share an account with somebody that they no longer live with or are no longer dating. There's things that are more likely to happen or have happened than the worst case scenario. But yeah, I don't know. It's tough. I was helping somebody opt out recently of these sites, and they'd already signed up for a paid service, but it still took me probably like 3 hours to remove all their information. And I've been doing this for years, so I probably go a lot faster than somebody who's new to it. And there's just no way. Unfortunately, there's not a lot you can do about that. I always joke that we should have a party with like a DJ and snacks together as a group.
That's really lovely. That, it's like you see the parties that people have where they're presenting slideshows to each other on their special topics. We should be having remove all your personal data from the internet parties as groups.
Yes, if there's like any to sponsor, but it would be so much fun.
You're listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Rae Johnston, and after speaking to Yale, I was a little bit excited and a little bit nervous to dip my toe into the world of auditing my digital footprint. First step, checking whether my email address is listed on Have I Been Pwned? Easy to use online tool that checks whether my email address has been included in any data breaches. All right, so I know about that one. I knew about... Oh, this one's not good. After this, I thought it was time we spoke to the man behind this terrifying, wonderful and useful website, Troy Hunt. Troy Hunt is an ex-Microsoft director and the creator of Have I Been Pwned? So Troy, for anyone who's never heard of Have I Been Pwned... What is it? Why did you build it?
Look, I built it originally after I found my own data in the Adobe data breach. And at the time, I was writing a lot about information security and working as a software developer. And I thought it was really interesting that that Adobe data breach, which had, I think, about 150 million people in it, not only had my data in the first place, which I thought was surprising because I couldn't remember giving it to Adobe. And I later realized I had given it to a company called Macromedia that Adobe had purchased, and my data flowed to places that I'd never expected. But I also found both my personal address and my work address because I had used Macromedia products in both capacities. And I thought, isn't it interesting? I can appear multiple times in a place I never expected. I wonder if other people would be surprised by this too. And it turns out the answer is yes.
Absolutely. And I've just opened up the site and punched one of my email addresses in because I do have multiple. And I am quite shocked by the amount of data breaches that my email address has appeared in, especially one that has revealed my physical home address, apparently. What kind of reactions do you find that people have when they see their personal information exposed like this, or that it has been exposed?
Look, it's often a bit of shock with people like, well, hang, you just sort of see the gears turning around, right? And they're just figuring out that why is my data, how do you know? It's just this confusion. And it's kind of fascinating because, of course, it gives you a little bit of a glimpse into people's lives. My wife is in a lot of fitness apps, for example. So I say, okay, you can start to sort of draw some conclusions about her. Of course, we've had some very, very volatile, sensitive data breaches, things like Ashley Madison. I mean, imagine how people feel when they find themselves in that breach.
Yeah, of course, of course. So, like, what kind of information is being used here? How is it being used in these breaches?
Firstly, all of it. can imagine it, it is out there.
I'm looking, one of these has my date of birth, email address, employers, gender, geographic locations, IP addresses, job titles, names, phone numbers, and physical addresses. One of these breaches, just one.
Yeah, and look, that's substantial, isn't it? And of course, it depends on the nature of the service. So yeah, that to me sounds like it might be a job-related sort of site. And you sort of go, okay, well, many of us have signed up to places like that. Of course, in 2022, we had a lot of news here in Australia about things like Optus and Medibank. Optus had our driver's licenses because that was part of how we do identity verification. Medibank has our medical history because that's the nature of a healthcare provider or healthcare insurer. You know, they need to retain that information. So depending on the nature of the organisation, that there's literally every conceivable possible class of data that's out there.
And I'm looking at this particular breach because I'm just astounded by the list of information that they have on me. It turns out that it's a verification website that's used by real estate agents when they process your application for a rental, which already has enough problems as it is, let alone them exposing all of our personal information, and is honestly something that I've always been concerned about when you look at the amount of requirements they have for applying for rental properties. This is astounding, Troy. I suppose you're used to hearing about this, though.
Look, I am, but it always sort of shocks me to have these first-hand experiences. I had a friend message me only a few days ago and said, so apparently someone's opened 6 bank accounts in my name and now I'm really scared to enter my data in anywhere, and I'm using one of the big credit protection services and they're asking for my passport. I don't want to give it to them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, mate, you kind of have to, you know, like to prove your identity.
If someone searches themselves on Have I Been Pwned and finds a bunch of breaches like I have, I am asking for myself here, Troy, but also everyone listening, what's the first thing they should do? What should I do having seen that?
Well, look, it really depends on the nature of the data that's exposed. Look, I mean, thinking back to that Optus period, the advice for folks was to go and replace their driver's licenses because that had been exposed. And of course, driver's licenses is however many points of identity verification, which could then be used to impersonate you. Many data breaches will expose your email address. Now, I don't really suggest changing anything there. You certainly can't go and change your email address every time it's been exposed. You know, maybe just a little bit more wary of possible spam and phishing. But of course, many data breaches also expose your password. And the advice there is always to make sure you have strong and unique passwords everywhere. Go and get a password manager, change it everywhere you've used it. And the unfortunate reality for most people, including probably 90% of people listening to this, is that they do have the same password everywhere.
Yeah.
Or the same 3 passwords, and they've got one for the strong stuff and one for the medium stuff, and one of those is exposed. So definitely strong and unique passwords is a massive part of it.
So are some kinds of data leaks more dangerous than others? Like what should we be really looking out for when it comes to what information about ourselves has been exposed?
Look, it's really a question of impact. So we mentioned Medibank. Now, if you are in that Medibank data breach, that impact could be quite varied. For me, I fortunately have a very boring health record. There's not going to be anything of interest in there. But if you recall the way that ransom process went down after Medibank didn't pay, they began by dumping a list of people that had abortions. Now, that's enormously sensitive information. So if you were in that Medibank breach and you had information that was very sensitive, what do you do?
Yeah.
You know, this is
yeah.
part of the problem as well, because once this data is leaked on the internet, you can never get it back. So in a case like that, you really can't do very much at all. In the other cases where it's things like identity data, or in your situation, you've got, you know, phone number, address, this sort of thing, using things like identity protection services can be very helpful. This friend of mine who just had 6 bank accounts opened, if he had have known the moment that the first one had an application submitted through to it, that might have been something that he could have mitigated damage on. So services that do look for things like credit inquiries are quite valuable.
Mm. So is there any way to not be in a breach in this
no.
day and age? This is just how we live now.
It's not. And look, I'll give you a good example why. I mean, some people say, well, just don't put your data on the internet. Now, that's, you know, A, that's infeasible because so much of what we do is on the internet today, particularly after COVID, when so many of us went online for all sorts of things. But also a lot of the other places where you might even put your data in pencil and paper form do end up on the internet. An example of that is I donated blood and I went to a blood van and I literally had a clipboard and a piece of paper and a pencil, and my data ended up in the Australian Red Cross Blood Service data breach in about 2016. I can't stop that from happening, and I'm not going to not donate blood. You know, that's not a good outcome either.
Yeah. So what do you do if you want to, you know, pull back some control over this? It feels completely overwhelming and completely unavoidable.
Look, there's a few fundamental things. I mean, the password one is a really obvious one. that. And I say this all the time, yet I'm still gainfully employed, so it's obviously not working. But having a password manager, a dedicated digital password manager, and making every password strong and unique. Do not, under any circumstances, ever reuse your passwords. That's an absolute fundamental. Things like those identity protection services are very useful as well. They're not necessarily expensive. They can be very easy to access, and they can certainly save you a lot of pain later on. Look, the other general guidance that we often give people is around data minimization. Try not to provide data that you don't have to. And something like your date of birth is a really good example. So how many websites ask you for your date of birth to sign up and talk about cats?
All of them.
Or to buy a T-shirt or something like that. Now, look, I'm sort of of the view that people should be able to have parties and celebrations and, you know, congratulations from friends by sharing their date of birth. But unfortunately, date of birth is what we call static knowledge-based authentication. It's static. You cannot change it. It's always the same value. And it's often used as a form of knowledge-based authentication because someone like your bank or your telco will say, look, just to prove you are who you say you are, what's your date of birth? You're sort of going, well, it's the things I tell everyone so I get presents. so minimizing the places that you provide that is a really good start.
Right. And what about people that are in high-risk situations, like activists, journalists, you know, survivors of abuse? Is there anything extra that they could be doing to stay safe?
Look, a combination of things, everything we've discussed already. You might also want to think about having different accounts for different purposes. So if you're doing online shopping, for example, perhaps you don't want to use the same email address as things that are tied to, say, activist activities. Then looking at things like the device. I mean, we often hear journalists, particularly in some parts of the world, are often targets of phishing or malware or very sophisticated state-backed adversarial sort of technologies. In cases like that, there are locked down modes for your iPhone, for example, where it limits the ability to access certain features. There are lots of other facilities, such as the ability to turn on data encryption on your device such that even your backups are encrypted and no one can access them. There's lots of other things you can configure on devices to make them more secure. But for the average person, that's generally more than what they need.
Hmm. Yeah, no, it really does feel a lot. It's when you start looking into it, but also I think one of the things that starts to happen, especially when we're getting emails every other week from places like Qantas and Optus to say that our data has been breached again, we end up with a bit of breach fatigue. Yeah, we're getting so used to hearing about all these leaks that we just go, oh, all right, all my stuff's already out there. What's the risk with that?
Look, breach fatigue is a term that comes up a lot. And, you know, maybe the Qantas one is a good example. I've had three emails myself from Qantas so far. I think I've had three for my 15-year-old son as well. And the difficulty for an organization like that is that they communicated very early, but it effectively said, we've had an incident. We don't know if you're impacted and we don't know how bad it is. And I sort of read it and went, well,
What are you telling me to do?
Yeah.
So they're just complying at that stage rather than actually wanting to give you information.
The difficulty for them is that if they wait too long, they'll be accused of sitting on their hands or trying to cover it up. If they go out too early, they give information that isn't actionable.
So the risk of us just going, oh, it's out there, there's not much I can do about it, they're real risks though, right? We should be staying vigilant.
Look, I understand the sentiment that there are certainly things you can do both before and after.
Yeah.
The password manager, strong, unique passwords, is both the before and after thing. I use a password manager. I have everything in there. Every password is unique. If my password does get taken by someone, they cannot use that anywhere else. And there's a password I have to change in one place, and that's it. Now, conversely, if I didn't have a password manager and I just learned that I was in a breach and my password got taken, I would go through all my accounts and immediately put them in a password manager.
Yeah.
I'd change all those passwords and make them strong and unique. So you can be both proactive and retroactive. Passwords go back to the very beginning. We've had passwords on computer systems for about six decades now, since the 60s. And passwords are fatally flawed in many ways. We reuse them, we commit them to memory. We tend to use things that are of a predictable pattern. And one of the problems with that is that it makes us vulnerable, particularly when we do see a security breach somewhere and your password gets taken, along with could be tens of millions of other people, and then those credentials get tested in other places. So the question is very often, how do we get rid of passwords? Now, to give passwords some credit, the reason they still work is because everybody knows how to use them. And whether you're tech savvy or tech illiterate, everybody knows how to store a, I'm air quoting this, but store a secret in their brain and then relay it somewhere. A lot of our path forward is around passwordless technologies, and pass keys is one that we're starting to see get a lot of traction. And pass keys are effectively digital files that get stored and synchronized across your devices. So if ever you're logging onto a website or signing up somewhere and you see the option for pass keys, they're definitely worth a look, particularly when they can completely replace the password or possibly act as a second factor that's required after the password.
Trey, I'd love to pose to you the overall question that we're trying to answer in this series, which is, do you think it's ever possible to get offline? Can we scrub our information from the internet? Can we exist without this?
So they say that trying to take your data off the internet is like trying to remove pee from a pool. So no, is the short answer. Not least of which, because even if you completely go off the grid, you know, I just gave the example of me donating blood and I'm back in there. The government still has records of you. We've had security vulnerabilities and data breaches of government entities, not just in Australia, but around the world. We've had things like the Philippines Election Commission had a data breach that exposed biometric data. There will always be digital records of you. You cannot change that. All you can do is mitigate the impact when they're exposed.
That was Troy Hunt, creator of the website Have I Been Pwned? You can head there to see whether your email has been included in a data breach, and you might be surprised at what you find. So, what do you even do if you've found out that you've been included in a data breach? After hearing from Troy and Yale, you would be forgiven for thinking that opting out is a monumental task. But there are a few things to remember. From Troy, use a password manager and make every password strong and unique, and turn on multi-factor authentication. Use passkeys when they're offered. Troy also said that it's important to share the minimum amount of personal data you can, especially your date of birth. It's what's often used to prove your identity, and you cannot change it. Don't hand it out if you don't have to. Yale also told us that we should all start our digital footprint audit with the information that worries you the most, usually, and in my case, your home address. You can check people's search sites, Googling combinations of your name and address, reviewing old accounts, removing what you can, and changing passwords for any breached accounts. You just have to start somewhere, and don't overwhelm yourself. Next time on Download This Show's special series, Opt Out, we'll be trying to delete all of this data from the internet and hearing from Electronic Frontiers Australia and the founder of data deletion site, Optory.
Like I said, it would be a Herculean enterprise, more like a Sisyphus, really. It's extremely difficult to delete the information that organisations hold about you.
And that's it for the first episode of Opt Out, the Download This Show guide to taking back control of your online life. You can listen to all the episodes of our special series now on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ray Johnston, and this has been another episode of Download This Show on ABC Radio National.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.